I've known Peter for over 30 years. We've spent time together during that time. We've worked at similar campuses, at the same campuses and on different buildings, of course. Peter has had a remarkable career, highlighted by winning the gold medal for architecture, which is, you know, handed out once a year. And so with that, what we're going to do is Peter's going to show some quick slides of his work. I will show some quick slides of my work, and then we'll engage in a conversation together and with all of you. And let me just say, it's great to see all these architects from Provincetown in the audience. So I didn't know there were so many of you. So Peter Boland.
Did you notice that Bill and I both say slides?
Yes, that's true, yes.
It's an old technology. I have 12 minutes to give you a visual sense of what I believe and what we believe as a practice. It has to do with the nature of people, both as individuals and as groups, how we all interrelate, how we touch, how we feel, how we move, how we remember, how we think, all of that. And the nature of places, where we are the climate, you know, the nature of a place. Is it forested? Is it a city? Is it the desert? Is it the Gobi Desert, for instance? And where the sun is, where the breezes are, all of that. And I believe also in getting at the nature of how we make things. These days, it's easy to forget that once primitive cultures could, they had to find the right answers within their circumstance. Their circumstance, to a great extent, shaped their culture. For instance, a nomad culture or an agrarian culture. That had a lot to do with where they were. And we've lost some of that, and so we'll chat about all of that in the next 11 minutes. We started that in Little Compton 17 or 18 years ago, and it was a competition, which I refused to do. Bill and I have chatted about this, doing competitions, which you sometimes do for various reasons, but prefer not to. In that case, I said no. But they hired us anyway. But when I was in school, undergraduate at Rensselaer, and then at Cranbrook Academy of Art, which was my antidote, I was always searching for how we make things. In the case of that child's shovel, that's a kind of scoop. But it tells you about how it was made. The texture of the wood, what was sawn, what was sanded, and so on. Or I was so lucky at Cranbrook because I had all the other arts or crafts, whatever you wish to call them, there, such as Marianne Strignel's clay potting studio. And I found out what, you know, architecture happens in elephant time, but as Eero Saarinen would say, but it is so good to now and then do things that are immediate, and particularly when they involve your hands, you know, whether it's with a pencil or playing with clay. And from my undergraduate days and Cranbrook, I was particularly interested in primitive buildings. Whether here in North Africa, or China, or Southwest, or radically different materials in Iraq, in southern Iraq, in their marshes. And there's, you could do, and I used to give 2-hour talks just on that subject. But, and how we make things. We all admire wood boats. And they're extraordinary, and they do the thing for us. I mean, we build them, but we row them, and we sail them. And so that is a great inspiration in principle and spirit to an architect. So about 10 years into our practice, or 9 years, I did a second house with my parents. And this is in Connecticut. And it was a kind of icon at the time.
Well published.
Yes. Well, that was good. Imagine starting in Wilkes-Barre, for God's sakes. And I did that. I did that because I went back and I knew I'd get a faster start. And after those years of schooling, Bill, you had even more schooling than I did. You want to get at doing what you love to do. And so that was the second house of my parents, and it was on the cover, and I believe that's why Bill Gates put us on his list. I never was sure of that, but I am sure of it now. And this is very recent, in the last year or two, in the Northwest. And again, another little building, and we've never given those up. And they never make money, the little ones. But if you're motivated by money only, you have to survive. I'd say you got it turned around backwards. That doesn't mean you don't have to be somehow wise about all of it. But that one in Northern California, which I don't know, Bill, you may have seen that.
No, I haven't.
Yeah. It's a sweet building. And it was right on the footprint. Only reason it got done next to the stream, on the footprint of what had been a little garage. You know, so it was grandfathered or grandmothered. But, oh, and I put in a slide of a little Compton, and we have done a number of things there. And there's that barn that you saw, but there it is saved. But there you also have the relationship between buildings. You're beginning to spot that. And the addition, we tore off a terrible addition on that little cape, that old building, and we made a new one that echoes it. But that wasn't, and we connected them with a minimal connection, just this little connection. So, you know, it's that game of modernism and the past and the present and the future, right? Bill Gates, the upper left, this is just reminding you that we've never given up the smaller buildings and larger houses, by the way, like Gates. The two upper left, the one on the right is Canada. And some, though, are very tough little budgets, and others, like this big one in Canada, is not a tough budget, but a wonderful site facing a glacier. And so that almost more than anything causes one to change one's means depending on where and who and what you're doing. And that's one reason we've always gotten pleasure, including being in Hawaii and the two last images. And having growing a garden on the roof of that room that you're seeing on the lower right. So getting at the nature of things, again, people and places and how you make things, but the nature of anything is, which is a kind of curiosity, is why it's such a pleasure doing the project at, in St. Louis. I was getting at the nature of that existing building and how you still make an athletic building, make the numbers work, all of that. now is a jungle of extraordinary flowers and gardens in the front. That was taken right after, and a tea house, Japanese tea house. It's up on stilts. And you see the kids on the right, quite purposeful. And that supports the roof, by the way, so we use the engineers we use on the Apple stores for that. How do you support with glass? Interesting. A half a mile from the St. Andrews Fault. And I wanted to do there on that one, we did, and I did. And this is a great client, by the way. The library of libraries, it's like having the, do any of you have a dog that you think is the dog of all dogs? I wanted to make a library of all libraries. So it was his private library, her private, the both clients. And the great paintings, that was a motta at the end. And he has two, these very large mottas. Yeah. But he has many other things. And probably one of the very best, and it all happened after we started the house, of modern antiques, has a Chereau desk from 1928. You know, the Maison de Verre, the architects know. And now he's got probably the best collection of about post-1970 California art. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Bill was born in California. I was born in the Bronx. But we have offices there now, and I'm there a lot. But this is a reminder about making things, you know, details, but also a reminder that hardware, about making things that people touch. And it's, I think architects in the past, more than modernism, and our culture, not just modernism, it's something to do with our, but it's not our culture. But it's not that costly to do these things. You know, it depends where and what you do. But we designed that and made it. And you notice you can grasp it. Why don't we do that? Because up to about 1930, architects did such things. So that's a number of projects, including those on the left. And so we should think about what people touch, not just what they see, not just to do the most utilitarian thing, particularly when you can figure out how to make the numbers work. Seems like a great, and so that's driving us. And it's driving us toward other buildings, I mean, such as, you know, we've done many projects for Apple, and Steve first hired us to do Pixar. And again, getting, it is a great challenge getting people to want to go down. I mean, that is a terrific challenge in retail. And we had Ron Johnson, who's on the left in this photo, next to Steve, as the vice president for retail. And he had been a Target, and he was the guy that changed Target to a great extent. And so we learned a lot from Ron. We did the first two-story stores, one in Soho and one in at the Grove in LA. But these were the study sketches that I was doing on the Cube in New York. So, how do you pull people down? And just a reminder. Some historic buildings, like the one of those Barcelona that I'm, maybe it's on the next group. Yes. That's Barcelona, the second up on the right. And some in Paris, some in London, some in the US, some in Canada. Sally's reminding me, watch out. But then there's civic buildings, and I guess you'd say for the public. And Bill reminded me, actually, to deal with this a little. And what a treat. And the mayor, they, when, you know, when you go through the normal interview process or you're selected, tough competitors. He said, I'd like you to make this like a home. Well, it's a big building. But that was a wise thing to say. And so, for instance, there's a fireplace in this room that gathers people. And that stair also acts as an amphitheater. And so there is a great thing about making, doing more than one thing at a time for architects. Architects tend to make, oh, that's a stair, this is a this, that's a that. Not always. You can actually achieve more than one thing. Buildings can do more than one thing. Parts of buildings can do more than one thing. All of that. That's another lesson about making things for people in our culture. And it's a sustainable attitude as well as and a humane attitude. And this happens to be Newport Beach. That was a competition bill, which we were the only non-California competitor. So,
but of course you have a San Francisco office, that helps.
I don't know that it did. I think it covered our backs.
Exactly.
But it, no more than that.
Yeah.
But I will say there were a number of architects on that selection committee. That made a difference. That. Yeah. But it's for people. And we made a great outdoor gathering space. We made indoor spaces. We and Peter Walker did that landscape with that group. But we had a great, we put a great team together. But also the smaller buildings for, in this case, nonprofit buildings, like Pocono Environmental Education Center. Most of the kids they serve are from the urban, like New York or Philadelphia. And they've never been in the forest before. They've never been in the natural world. So how do you do that? Well, they all collected tires in the Delaware River, and we made that entry face, and then it's a great pavilion facing the south, and you know, catching the sun, shading the sun you don't want, catching the breezes. But that face is cut from tires. So I think that their grandkids will remember this. I think they're going to bring their grandkids back, those children that are there now. And they will remember, and they'll remember that wall was made out of refuse. And the kids operate that building just as our, let me put it there. No, I think I took it out. We did another Girl Scout camp outside of Philly, and there, the girls operate, and it was meant to be, and they asked it to be a passive solar building. And what a treat to work on that. But the children operate it. And imagine the difference if people operate things and not just machines. Now, I realize that most of our world inevitably will be machines. But one thing about houses or smaller buildings or buildings for children, you can get them to work for children and other people and not just say, well, we'll do it for you. And I think that's a great lesson. They'll remember where the sun is. They'll remember where the wind is. They'll remember that they should shade and not shade, depending on how much heat. So that's a great lesson. And this is a little library in Seattle, Ballard. And again, it's very thoughtful building having to do with energy and daylighting, which is a monster deal, and the use of materials. And the children there are looking through slots up a periscope at the roof. And no signs. They figured out so much better. Yeah. So that has to do with our culture. That's one reason to do all scales of things, even if some of them aren't economically viable for us. Well, but we have a practice that is viable, or that wouldn't be around for now 52 years. But we do what we want to do. We figure out how to do it most of the time. And the Tetons. How do you do a building there for the public? And you know, the Park Service is a very good bunch, but they're quite controlling. I think you've found this out once or twice around here. And yet it's good they're there, but they don't want one place to be better than the other. Have you figured that one out? And so we had a good foundation here, and they were tough. So, and at the time, you had a good superintendent. You really need those. So people approach this building and this court, and then they enter the building. They see the Tetons over the top of the building, but they don't really see them until they're inside. And we've lined things up, see the little stripes in the floor, on the various peaks. And we made the budget work too. Spill knows about this because he was in the process in which we were selected. And it's one story on the court. You see the section here? It's one story on the quadrangle side, and on the other side it's three stories. Therefore, melds in, and it's next to a Gothic chapel, and therefore we related very carefully to that chapel with the scale and the detailing, as you see in these limestone columns. We both worked at Williams and enjoyed that.
Someone in the audience.
Yes. But there you approach, we in the college saved Stutzen, that building. And the stack space was no longer viable. We were using it for offices and stuff, I think. And so you see how we made another kind of place in the lower right. And then you enter the world of most of the books and the students looking out to the north and the views, actually to the east, and to the views of the mountains, you know, the Green Mountains, all of that. But we've done any number, including an art museum in the lower right, but any number of buildings on various campuses, and their circumstances are different. And they're all quite different. You know the D school at Stanford. This is the new D school we're working on at University of Illinois. It's really an interesting program because it has to do with breaking down the silos, getting students to interact. And Pixar, workplace. And Square, workplace. And we continue to do little and large buildings. That's housing on the left, with shopping on the lower levels. For a tough budget, by the way. Unfortunately, a rather innovative contractor, developer, who's Chinese by birth. And lastly, favorite little recent building at Falling Water. It's housing for summer students. Thank you.
Thank you, Will. Thank you. So I've chosen to aim for 7 or 8 minutes. We'll see how successful I am. Wanted to share what's interesting. In many ways, Peter and I share the same attitudes about architecture, but I've chosen to do it in a different setting, in the sense that I do think architecture is a public art, and it's all about the public realm. And so our practice has really concentrated on architecture about connecting to the city and really engaging the city and the citizens of the city and buildings, about connecting to campuses, as Peter's has too, recognizing that, you know, Thomas Jefferson was a great American architect and set a standard that very few of us can ever achieve at the University of Virginia. And it's all about the sense of community. Of course, at UVA, you all know that you have the pavilions for where the professor lives, you have the range houses where the students live, and they're gathered around a green that with the library at the head of the green. It's a wonderful statement about education that applies today as well as in 1825 when he built it. A third category of the public realm are performance spaces, about why and how people come together, whether it's for music or dance or theater, seems important to us. And then a very hard practice, and Peter's done it too, is civic buildings for public agencies, whether they're city halls or courthouses, and yet I think it's a really important category. So it's the public realm and the idea of architecture having to stand up in the public dialogue that we care all about. So at Seiji Ozawa Hall was our, you know, a major first project for us. We designed a concert hall which had a 50-foot wide door which opened, 1,200 seats opening to a lawn audience of another 3,000. We had a great acoustician, Larry Kierkegaard, and people will say when they're in that building that it sounds the same whether that barn door is open or closed, and we're proud to have been part of that. We also think of concert halls as places of real intimacy. This is the idea that you can see the whites of the eyes of people on all three sides of you. It's not like the high school auditorium that I went to, where the only thing you saw was the neck of the front person in front of you. And of course, then you get into the details of wood, much like Peter was talking about. A very different kind of performance space is here at Berklee College on Massachusetts Avenue in Boston. A second story space, which is music by night. Almost every night, the students are performing in one way or another. And it's a dining commons by day, and it has to be both. And it's all about being able to see all of this going on from the city, and really connecting the students to the city and the city to the students. So here you can see in its dining setting, and here you see it in its performance setting overlooking the city. Another is at Williams College, which is about, 1,000 yards from Peter's building, and this is about getting a contemporary spirit of a building right on the main street of Williamstown, which is not the most contemporary city you've ever been to. But it's also about being inventive, and there are four venues. The most interesting, perhaps, is this what we call the studio theater. I won't go into the details, but it's about the next generation of the black box. The black box takes a whole semester for the students to get a hold of the space before they can even do anything about drama. The studio theater is about giving them a bunch of things to to hang on to as they're moving through the course of a semester. And we also have instituted in many projects the idea of a big barn door opening the main corridor into that that performance space, no longer the idea of going through sound and light lodge. It's a very different attitude about theater, and it can get quite complex, although these are all hand-drawn gondolas in the air, they're for safety reasons, and it's about there are four venues, including major dance facilities. Coming to Thomas Jefferson at the University of Virginia, we were hired to do the arts precinct, planning the arts precinct, and then we've done two buildings in it. This is the theater building, a Thrust Theater, built into the hill, and as you come up the stairs, windows opening so you can watch a rehearsal, you can watch sets being built. It's all about connecting, again, that theater to the campus, and you will say, well, how do you deal with a light in a theater? And here is the windows overlooking that theater, and the university has started choreographing the whole presentation, much like the curtain opening in the proscenium theater. This is the blackout shades come down just as the performance is about to start. So it's a much more visible performing space than you would find in a normal college. Likewise, the synagogue in Wellesley, Massachusetts, this is opening onto a courtyard surrounded by Jerusalem stone. We joke, the Boston Globe joked, that we went to Israel with a building committee to teach me about Judaism and to teach the building committee about architecture, and this is the result. This is an east-facing wall, as you would expect in a sanctuary, with a wood grill protecting you from the east sun on a Saturday morning. Very flexible space, and it was a fun project. Public buildings, as I say, are difficult. This is the federal courthouse in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, on the end of a major boulevard in the city. It's on axis with the boulevard, and the idea here was to make, obviously, judicial activities much more transparent and much more public, even as the security issues in these kind of buildings have gotten to be next to impossible. But here you can see the six courthouse doors visible to the city daytime and nighttime, and to us that was a really important way to bring a public building to the public. And here's the corridor system connecting to those courthouse courtrooms. Similarly, at Cleveland Clinic, which we just opened in February, a very glassy building, and it's glass on all four sides, and the daylight inside the space and the access of people to that daylight is very direct. You can see the very contemporary entrance, but you can see the interior. The CEO of the Cleveland Clinic believes in contemporary architecture. He thinks it reflects the kind of excellence that the clinic seeks to bring. And as he says, these cancer buildings where you have a fireplace and bookshelves kind of emulate someone's living room or den as a place to be, that's not what people want. They're very preoccupied with their condition. They're not going to be swayed by kind of house-like elements, with all due respect to the fireplace in Seattle City Hall. And so he believes that the contemporary architecture shows an excellence that makes the patient really confident that when they walk into a doctor's office, that they're going to get the same kind of excellent service. As I've said, we work a lot in universities, as many of you know. This is was an important set of buildings for Northeastern, and this is, of course, a four-story College of Computer Science, and then on top of it are 12 stories of dorms, and the two connect very directly. Again, this idea that universities aren't single silos, but in fact, places where there's real interaction. I won't go into that in great detail, but here again, that's computer science and the north-facing window wall of that building. Milton Academy, which is like a university, like a small college, we were able to do a science building, fitting it in quite tightly into an already existing campus. But the whole idea was to have glass walls on all the lab spaces so the students get, as the faculty would say, the excitement of science. And I kind of say that's totally different from the kind of science I was exposed to at that age. And I will acknowledge John Duhon here. He's excited me about science, and I wasn't excited before meeting him. But all kidding aside, it's you can see the nature of being able to see in and see what's going on in science is really important. Applies to a whole set of other academic enterprises too, though many faculty members are very nervous about doing that. And at Wash U in St. Louis, we did a dorm project. This is part of the dorm above a market, actually. It was part of the university's revitalization of a small commercial district about four blocks from the university. Truro resident Mr. Dubinsky in the audience is a trustee there, so I'm glad he's here to see this. You can see how it's a contemporary building and an otherwise very early and early 20th century shopping district that we've brought this very contemporary spirit and the contemporary spirit of Wash U, which, as you all know, many of you know, in fact, we have a graduate in this audience too, as many of you know, is a Gothic campus. So this was a counterpoint, if you will, to that. Cambridge Library, which is one of our major Boston projects located on a park in Cambridge, we brought very ubiquitous sustainability programs from Germany and created a double skin glass wall, which gives thermal protection to the people inside the library and yet connects them very directly to the park outside. And this is a south-facing space and has a louver system protecting you from the sun. So it's a very sophisticated yet simple for the people to operate. We call it a double skin curtain wall system. And so you can see these are for additional protection so that people in the library can get right out to the park edge and feel like they're part of the park. Likewise, we have glass on all four sides of the building, literally all four sides plus a skylight coming from above. So the place is suffused in natural light in a way that is very different. Be careful when you have one glass wall, as architects in this room will know. You get glare and it's not at all pleasant. You have to be in a space like this where you get light from all sides. And finally, this is a not very attractive photograph of a Philip Johnson, a 1970 addition to the Kim Mead and White famous building at the Boston Public Library. Notice the granite wall keeping you out. Notice the tinted glass so you can't see in. And it's been a problem for the city for 45 years, and this is what we did. We opened it up, took out those walls, put in new glass, created a three-bay, we call it Boylston Hall, all along Boylston Street, making it incredibly attractive. The minute you walk in the door, WGBH has put a radio facility at the end of this this space, so it adds another aspect of reaching out to the public. And So we still use, this is part of the, more like the old Johnson. Well, this was that space with under Johnson. We put in stairs and increased access to the mezzanines. But here, of course, you see in, and it's all about the city connecting to the library. So you can see, and I want to mention Bruce Stanzer, who does a lot of our interiors work, was deeply involved in this project. So as you can see, our focus has been very much on the public realm and architecture as a public art and how to serve as broad a public as possible. So that's a way to kind of introduce a bunch of questions, and maybe there are two big questions I have for Peter, and I think particularly important. Let's just get to Steve Jobs quickly. Peter got to work closely with a design icon in this in our culture, and also a man who deals with technology, obviously in a very special way. Tell us about how you got involved. What were the challenges and the joys of working with him on the Apple stores?
Well, at the time we were working at doing Bill Gates' house. I don't think Steve Harness had, I know it had nothing to do with that. But he had his fellows call up and asked me to come down. And that's to do Pixar, and that's how that started. And so, and I recall that at Pixar once, and Steve and I then didn't know each other as well as we did, but we did know each other. And he looked at a detail, because it faces that center space that I showed swiftly faces north. So it does, with a factory building, you'd, in that area actually, many buildings, you'd bring in this north light. And he said, Peter, you're going to hell over this. I don't think I told you this, but I'm not sure. And usually I dissemble in a case like that, but in that moment I didn't, and I said, Bill, or Steve, I don't believe in hell, but if I did, you'd be there. And he looked at me, and I thought, oops. And he said, well, we'd both be there, and we'd be friends. So, Steve was a sweet guy in ways, and that illustrates that. But also, I've seen him really beat people up, too. But we had a good relationship. And I think he required.
So what aspects of the Apple store would you give us as an example of the collaboration between you and he, where both of you had a strong impact on the design?
And also Ron Johnson, who's in that photo as well, who was head of retail. I think he, we'd meet maybe once every 2 weeks. And we would be dealing with a range of issues, such as, is this a new building? Well, many of the buildings, particularly as we began to do more in Europe or China, were in existing conditions, particularly Europe. And to a greater extent as time went on, in some notable existing places in the U.S., like the newest store we did on Upper Madison. I don't know if any of you have been to that, but it's inside of a little old bank, and I like it. It's near the old Whitney. We were always, I can speak for myself, always quite aware of Steve's sensibilities. For instance, beyond the fact that he was driving very hard to make his place, everyone said these would fail. And I remember very early in the relationship is saying, you know, I must do this. We have no choice because we're being marginalized by being sold in, you know, other vendors, other retail stores. And so it had to be notable, and it clearly, and he had to do it, and people said he'd fail. I don't know if you recall those days. You know, it was clear that, oh, Steve's out of his skull. And so we worked, we made full-scale mock-ups in some big warehouse buildings not too far from the headquarters in California. And we not only to look at details, but to look at a whole space, particularly when you're dealing with a lot of those stores were standard, more or less standard stores in a shopping center or in a some other circumstance of that sort. And so we would go through three or four versions. He'd be very much involved. In my mind, I felt that what we were dealing with was a cold thought of modernism, certainly from my vintage, and that's making universal space. You know, which people like me sort of talked about, guys like Conrad Boxman, whom he's valued greatly, thought of that and enabled it with his structures. And so we began to look at the ceiling systems, and you'll note that all pretty disciplined in a thoughtful way, and they're minimal. And then we kept pushing the technology. As we began, I think the first store where we really dealt with glass was in Soho, and we made a glass.
Is that ahead of the General Motors building? Or?
Yes, it was the first one in New York. And we made it, I think the New York Times said it was a kind of similar build to your concerns about relating, you know, cultural, making cultural places that enable people, that's how I see it. We did that with Soho. That became a kind of place for Apple people and others in Soho to gather. And so that's a lesson about making, if you make really good places, they tend to be used for more than one thing. And they are much, and that's something never to forget. And you and I both know that very well. So it was a kind of interesting thing. I miss him a lot. As a person, particularly, I'm rather touched by him. But he could be a real prick. So, you know, it was a wonder, and it was a great time in all of our lives.
And did he, were there things in the store that people would recognize that he insisted on in your design process?
I think Steve might say everything.
Okay.
It finally got clearer that we were the architects.
Right.
You know, but I believe it's now about people for just a moment. When people are involved with each other, and whether they're within a practice like yours or mine, and I certainly, you know, value and greatly my partners and my many people in our practice. And I think we do better things together than we could possibly do alone. And that, you know, people tend to think of heroes, you know, or heroines, sort of Ayn Rand, which I always hated. But that, I don't think it's true. I think at our very best, most of us do benefit from others. So we certainly did that at Apple.
A different question. Tell us what kind of building you'd love to do that you haven't been able to do yet.
And I want to hear your answer to that.
Well, my answer is very easy because I'd love to do an art museum.
And so would I. And we've done one now.
You've done one. I've not done one.
That's a joint venture.
We were part of a competition for Peabody Essex up in Salem, but we didn't win the competition, yeah. Which is a whole other story. But but I have the feeling I may never get to do one.
And I think you will, Bill.
It saddens me because you look at some of, I happen to think Renzo Piano's DeMille Museum in Houston is, you know, one of the kind of great buildings of American architecture.
Well, Bill and I share these thoughts.
And I also think Piano's Nasher Sculpture Museum is just extraordinary in Dallas. It's interesting that Texas gets some of his best work. Tom Pfeiffer's a museum in Raleigh, North Carolina. It's a state museum run by the state of North Carolina. It's an extraordinary building.
It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, and so, you can see in our work, we've tried to be inventive about how a concert hall can be built open to the outside, let's say, or theaters, all about connecting outside the theater box. And I'd love to be able to explore that idea in museums. But what about you?
Well, I have the same feeling about the arts.
I see.
And I'd like to do more and more things having to do with performance.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So similar interests, because it has, I think it's a similar view. I believe in people interacting, and anything that can generate that or encourage that is a good thing, because otherwise our culture's becoming very, could easily become the reverse of that, with less direct interaction.
And I think, obviously, I think the best architects in America do a good job of that, but we are faced with so many buildings, public buildings or even private buildings that aren't about that, and their economic imperatives. You look at developer buildings in this country, they are not about doing that generally.
But office spaces like Square, which we've done for Jack Dorsey, who's a terrific client.
Yep.
And I think he found us. I think it was because of Apple, particularly. But again, to be able to work, to make workplaces, so-called workplaces, that, again, encourage those same kind of human interactions is a really good thought.
So I certainly have some more questions for Peter, but I think we should open it to the audience.
Yeah, and your questions for Bill. I would just say, Bill, may I, for a moment? It's a question. How would you see, I think you've said this, but maybe restate it, your role or your desire above all else? How would you,
in role, you mean
in your life
design
as
process,
an architect?
The design process, or
no, not the process.
How I got to architecture,
no.
Or what?
What you believe you want to represent, what you want to do.
Well, I come from a political background, and it's kind of restating what I've said a moment ago, that I think the whole issues in our culture are about connecting people from different worlds, different walks of life, on a campus, different disciplines, in the city, from different economic and racial and ethnic divisions. And I think it's imperative that architects respond to that very directly and not hold back. And I do think in architecture you have to kind of overstate a point of view from a design point of view to make sure that that view still survives all the problems of getting a building built.
Yeah.
I mean, the process of building buildings is is really complex, involves a huge number of people. It's not just a single architect by any means. It's a team of architects. It's their consultants, like I've mentioned. It's the client, but then it's the contractor who has to build according to drawings, and that can get screwed up. The cost issues, the clients don't have the money to do what they really want to do, and yet they insist they can make it work, and that's always hard. But so that, all of those things it's not like writing poetry or doing a painting. Much more, with all due respect to your field, Julia, you get to go to your library and write your book. But you have publishers and other people you have to deal with. So.
Well, you rely on so much, don't you, others?
Yes, absolutely.
And I do. And so I don't see me as the great creator. And I don't think you see you that way. We're sort of a hybrid, aren't we?
So let's open some questions, yes. Now the question is, how do you design in a contemporary way when you know that years later it won't be contemporary, and how does it hold up?
Or it'll change somehow.
So go ahead.
Well, global warming even makes this more complicated, because if you begin to think about it, I don't know if anyone would disagree with this, but there's no doubt it's happening, and it's going to escalate. So I figure, Sally and I live an example, and this comes back to this bill. When we're in Seattle, we live in a little fishing shack, and I think it's probably good for 20 years. That's all. Now it sits on the sand, but the ocean is rising. We now get high tides in the house, usually about like this much, but then it runs out. That's fine. But think about what 5 and 10 and 20 feet are going to mean, or when, if Antarctica does melt, as it appears to be, that could be over 100 foot, right? I was told 150, 140 feet. Well, this won't be here. Even at 150 feet, I don't think this building could be here. Now that's, 200 years off to three. So that complicates it even more. For instance, because this back bill, when we all have many of our buildings are near the edge of the continent,
yep.
I think they're not gonna be there in 5 or 10 generations, unless there's a really radical shift. St. Louis will be there.
So, or the visual contemporary, yeah. Not the physical durability.
I
just wanted to throw that in to make it more complicated.
But no, I think if, I mean, you take Boston, you Copley Square, you've got H. Richardson Trinity Church, you've got McKim's initial BPL building. Those are great buildings, and they hold up even in a contemporary time. And yet they're right next to the John Hancock Building, which is another great building. And I think I would say high quality contemporary work of a contemporary moment holds up over generations and actually speaks to the changes in life in a country that is a defense of contemporary architecture. I see someone coming to this. Go ahead, we'll try another one.
Warren, if you had a magic wand and you could redo the Boston waterfront, what would your vision be for it? And my second question is, what are your views on Boston City Hall, a very controversial
building? We let the outsiders say a word, and then I'm happy to. So waterfront or City Hall, which one do you want to take?
I think we both do it. I'll do it quickly. I think access to the edge of things is always crucial, highly desirable. One nice thing about Boston's waterfront now, it's somewhat porous because of the wharfs being turned outward. But I would remind you again that global warming is going to change this radically over the next generations. And that is something cannot be ignored. But I don't know that, and I don't think we're going to be able to deal with it totally. We've got to do our damnedest. But I'm not sure that we're going to deal with that. And I think one has to face up to that. What does it mean for the edge of all the great cities on the, you know, that border the ocean, not just Miami, or but Boston and Providence? I think, you know, some places can build dams and things like that, but at some point, I'm not sure that's going to work. So I just throw that in, Bill, as a, well, to make it a tougher question.
I mean, that's an interesting point. At the same time, those wharfs go perpendicular to the land, the land edge, and can be so privatized so quickly unless the powers that be, and those are city governments, keep control of making sure those wharves are public spaces. Massachusetts has a pretty good law, Chapter 91, and yet it's being ignored in many places. And then you take the seaport, the South Boston seaport area, with all those glass buildings filling out to the very edge of their property lines in these glass boxes, which, yes, there's a public way, the street is public out to the waterfront, but if you have to walk through three or four blocks of glass boxes that are all private office spaces, you don't feel at all welcome. So I think the question has raised a powerful question that Boston is, for 30 years, has actually turned its back on the waterfront, even as much as they're saying that they aren't. You can take the analog here in Provincetown, look at the people who keep trying to keep us from getting to the waterfront here, the perpendicular streets that used to run down the water's edge get blocked by one machination or another, and so I think it's a really important question in Boston that the political leadership has not yet confronted. As to Boston City Hall, I will say the Johnson, I will only say the Johnson building was not particularly beloved, and I'd like to think we've made it beloved. And I think the Boston City Hall, which we as architects, most of us think is a brilliant building done by two brilliant architects, and they're young in their careers. One's now deceased. I think architects would say, most architects in the city would say it's a great building. And as such, then it behooves us and the city government to figure a way to make it beloved by a broader citizenry, which of course has, we know, we are aware that it's not beloved. And it needs radical transformation, but it's not about tearing it down. So.
And we have time for just one more quick question.
Okay, Matt Kiefer.
We could go on for hours.
Yeah, well, your time is right, I guess. Better to be lucky than smart. Thanks for a great presentation, and thanks for your great work. They're, I think of them as sort of gifts to all of us that you've given us. So, really simple question for both of you. Do you prefer malleable clients or opinionated clients? Who gets the best work?
Say that a little more clearly.
Do you prefer clients who have opinions about design or clients who don't? Who gets your best work?
Bill, you go first.
I honestly believe that the strong-willed client that is articulate about what their will is makes for the most interesting client. They've thought about these issues, they confront you, you have to confront them back. And so I look at our best work, and by and large, they were with clients who were very articulate about a vision, a new vision for, you know, Ozawa Hall, the BSO in those days was articulating a a powerful vision for the growth of Tanglewood. And so we kind of understood what they wanted to, and they were articulate about it. I will say, however, that since this is being broadcast, I probably shouldn't quote a well-known architect who did a very well-known building in Boston, worked for a client which actually didn't have strong opinions, and he saw his role as educating the client and not being cowed by the client, and also fighting the battles to win the client over. So he was, I've always said the...
Made him better, made the work
exactly,
better.
Exactly, made the work better. So I know there's a, but I think those are the rare circumstances. And I think by and large, very articulate, clear clients by far make the best builder. So.
Yeah, I would just refine, like watching a watch. I was watching it. I would refine that, or at least from my perspective. The ideal clients are strong, but open to thinking and talking about what that means. And so you'd like people that are not so directive, unless they're right on. Steve is close to being right on. You'd like people that are strong and that do have some vision, but on the other hand are interested in the dialogue. That, and probably Bill means that when he says strong, but
yeah, yeah.
But it's a little different than people just, we have one or two clients that are very strong-willed, but they're wrong. No, but you do your damnedest for them, or you shouldn't work for them. And in my case, I continue to work for one because I don't know who else could deal with it and do better. No, really, it's very difficult. So
I think we're probably out of time.
But this is an interesting issue, Bill. It's a very interesting issue. I think I wanted to say one thing. One of the first National Honor Award we got was for a little house. I don't know if you recall it, Bill, because I'm older than you. Inside of a stone barn foundation. That client was a great client. And he was the equivalent of being from a taste or aesthetic, so-called, point of view. He was amoral. He didn't have bad taste. He had no taste. He had no sense of design. But he was willing. And that was an interesting client too, because I could really delve into his nature. In fact, he had been in the Peace Corps. He had what he was like. And he didn't have to have a strong view himself. But I was able to delve in to him. And I always thought he was like being immoral from a, taste point of view. He didn't know. So it depends a lot. And I'm not sure as a public client, that would be the best thing at all. It was a large building. There had to be a one-on-one situation.
Okay, you're great. Thank you.